Actinic keratoses are the second most common reason patients visit the dermatologist. In the final podcast in this three-part educational program, Dr. Neil Bhatia discusses tips and provides advice for AK management, treatment, reimbursement, and more. Here's Dr. Bhatia.
Hi, this is Dr. Neil Bhatia. I'm the Director of Clinical Dermatology at Therapeutics Clinical Research in San Diego, California. And I'm going to talk a little bit about actinic keratoses, some do's and don'ts, a few topics about what are we learning from the guidelines, as well as some ideas on, what to do and what can we be doing better. So first thing, when we think about do's and don'ts of actinic keratosis management, we have to talk about why are we treating in the first place? What are we treating and what are we missing by not treating? And some of that goes back to, the narrative that we have to have with patients. So why are we getting into, the discussion of field therapy, of treating, with topical prescriptions? You have patients who talk about, I don't want to get red. I don't want to, just do anything that makes my skin slough off. But they also don't like liquid nitrogen because it leaves them blotchy. They're worried about photodynamic therapy because they don't want to spend the time or they think they're going to get red. What we have to accept is that Medicare patients are no longer the AK patients alone. We have 30 and 40-year-olds with AKs. Many of them have good insurance. Many of them also don't want the downtime. So we have to really think that through. And again, I laugh a little bit because, dermatology patients, they never go out in the sun. Right? In San Diego, California, Florida, sunniest areas, first thing a patient says is, I didn't go out in the sun. And even more so, they say, I don't want to use sunscreen because I heard it causes cancer. So they forget that the big ball in the sky is what causes the skin cancer. And even more so, they worry about what's going to hurt, and they forget that surgery of skin cancer also hurts. And then we have to get back to definition. And one of those definitions is precancerous. Everyone likes the term precancerous for AKs, but pre is a really bad prefix because it really adds to ambiguity. Precancerous is still a discussion of cancer, right? I make fun of the term pre-boarding at the airport because it's still boarding, right? And pre-game of a sporting event is still part of the game itself. So we have to think of the cancerous part of actinic keratoses, which was once called keratinocyte carcinoma, and think in terms of what are we doing to treat not only the ones that we see, but the ones on the way. And some of that comes back to, again, the understanding that actinic keratosis truly regress. And there are numbers out there that show that, anywhere from 0.016 to 0.24 to even 8% numbers, these are all different numbers that show a potential recurrence rate or regression rate. But there are also numbers that show that almost 80 to even 100% of invasive squamous cells had an AK that it was arising from. So we don't want that one AK that we don't treat to be the one that gives rise to the squamous cell. And again, that goes back to the understanding of, where are the hot spots, like the cheeks and temples, for example. We also have, again, the understanding of, how many can progress to squames from AKs. There's also, again, how many of those that can regress? Do we really want to take a chance and watch those rather than treating it? So what's nice is, in Europe, they're doing a lot of studies about what they call severe actinic keratoses, and they're grading those a little bit higher in terms of their squamous cell risk, even more so as, again, we're teaching, non-physicians to identify skin cancer in cosmetology curriculums and in cosmetic outcomes, even in hair salons. We're giving them identifying photos and showing them, have you seen these spots on someone's head? You should send them to the dermatologist right away. But switching gears to talk about, the concept of treating the whole field comes back to pain and gain. A lot of patients will say, I don't want to look red for a couple of weeks, but I know that at the end of the rainbow, things will look a lot better. And some of that goes back to management. So, for example, in the Journal of Clinical Aesthetic Derm, JCAD, there was a group of us who talked about pain management, both with actinic keratosis treatment topically as well as with photodynamic therapy. So we talk about using a fan, a cooling air, solution like a mist, but avoiding direct tissue cooling because of the impact it has on conversion of ALA. Some of it too, just some of the topicals like topical promoxine, topical, lidocaine cream for immediate pain relief, and some of the other things that we work on really do have an impact both with the topical treatments such as imiquimod and 5-FU and the new terbinibulin ointment, but also with in-office procedures. So again, what we're learning too is that there's a real increase in the use of 5-FU and calcifafine. And we talk about this a lot at conferences, you know, can we use them together at the same time? You know, calcifafine is a very fussy agent to use individually. I'm sorry, in combination, because its pH is very high. And you know, part of the problem with, you know, the way we use it in psoriasis with the topicals is they're confined to different vessels within the vehicle, which is allowed for them to be, you know, in the same one topical agent, versus what we're seeing with compounding the 5-FU and calcifafine. There may not be adequate stabilization of the compound to allow for it to penetrate. Now, that being said, you know, using the two tubes separately has become a very common adjunct, and it's doing its job. It's just the question of is it something that patients will tolerate. And we're seeing that, you know, become a little bit of an issue with the combination, as they studied it alone, and the 49%, there was almost 40% irritation and burning and stinging as compared to 5-FU alone, which is already a high number. So again, you know, the data itself is good. It's just a question of, you know, can we get it into the hands of those patients? You know, again, turning to, you know, liquid nitrogen, you know, we have to remember that liquid nitrogen alone has been shown to have about 30% histological clearance of AKs, which is a concerning number. So let's think about, you know, how do we incorporate, you know, topicals. So I think tobenibulin ointment has done a good job of showing us, you know, how we can get 5 days of treatment with a mild ointment-based vehicle that's easy to spread and has an even distribution, but also what it's working on is more apoptosis and cell blebbing that's basically phagocytized, rather than cell necrosis, which has created, you know, more, you know, local skin reactions and inflammation. And you'll see a lot of patients, you know, with tobenibulin ointment, you know, they get a little bit dusky pink, a little bit of flaking and scaling, but they don't get that heavy crust like you see with desquamation, like with 5-FU and inguinal mebutate. They don't get that dense induration like with imiquimod cream. And again, you know, the reality is we're seeing more and more studies where the PROAK, for example, PROAK study, showed, you know, again, how patients appreciated a better overall appearance, as well as what they're seeing in terms of, you know, their skin looking a little bit better as well as feeling better. And that same concept goes along with photodynamic therapy, where we're seeing patients who've had a couple of treatments, so even though they get red and have to stay indoors for a day or two, they're actually seeing, you know, significantly less roughness, less dyschromia, and they actually feel like their skin is feeling better in terms of, you know, what it looks like, you know, in the mirror as well as with texture. So what we have to think about too is, you know, some of the issues that go along with reimbursements. Excuse me, because, you know, obviously CMS is watching the utilization of the 17004 codes, and they're taking notes on how many AKs are treated, how many times we're using these codes, and are they going to be under suspect? You know, the RUC committee defends our use of, you know, liquid nitrogen and how we manage and how much time is spent, but we have to be smart in terms of, are we mixing in some other treatments like photodynamic therapy and using those codes correctly? First of all, we have to match the codes for the appropriate light device, as well as talk about the time. And time is really important with PDT to have the best outcome. So, for example, you know, 2 hours of incubation is where you get the maximum 100% conversion of exogenous ALA to protoporphyrin 9. For those who incubate less than that or even an hour, you really only get about 60% of that conversion. That's on the fluorescence. So really see a big difference. The same goes along with heating. When you warm the skin, you actually get better conversion of apoptosis and more, you know, apoptosis-positive cell marker. And you also get a better conversion of reactive oxygen species, which is what you need for successful PDT. But there was a study done in Cleveland Clinic by Dr. Ed Maiden where they put faces to the patients, and they actually looked at immediately starting the light after application of ALA for that side, and they treated for 30, 45, or 60 minutes, whereas the other side of the face, they began the blue light an hour later after incubation, treating with a conventional 16 minutes and 40 seconds. And the pain was probably better, or I should say less, on the simultaneous side. But the question becomes, is that a lot of time under the light, and is there any other change? You know, because again, if you're sitting under the light for an hour, you're really both, you know, using a lot of bulb, and essentially, you know, you're exposing the patient to all that light versus letting them incubate with less light. So if the pain is the issue, that really shows that maybe we need to do some more things adjunctively. The other part of the equation, again, is, you know, things like oral vitamin D have really not shown itself to be useful, but sunscreens with photolysis and DNA repair have actually shown to be really effective in reducing P53 expression and Ki-67 expression. And what they found in Europe was they actually did studies with PDT and the photolysis, and they found that those patients who used those sunscreens, you know, had fewer needs for PDT. They could actually skip a treatment because of their improvement. So the last thing we'll just touch on is, again, knowing the right code. The J7345 is the code for the 10% ALA gel, and 7308 is the code for the 20% stick. And we want to get away from the old code of 96567 and use the code 96573 and 96574, which involves curettage. And even more so, it's important for the clinician, whether it's a MD, DO, NP, or PA, that one of those levels has to be involved with the treatment, whether it be turning on the light, applying, or what have you. I think as long as they're involved with the care, that's how we can use those other coding algorithms. So I think with that, I'm going to stop there, and we'll pick up on some new things with actinic keratosis later on. And hopefully we've learned a few things about the medical and the PDT management, or photodynamic therapy management with actinic keratosis. So my take-home lesson is always just to make sure we're treating adequately, treating through the disease, treating the ones that are on their way, and keeping skin cancer at bay is probably our best approach to these things.
This has been an exclusive podcast with the Dermatology Digest. Find more at www.thedermdigest.com. Thank you for joining us.